Hi, this is Josh Barrow. On Thursday, October 20th, KCRW is coming out of our basement studios for a civilized, yet provocative, Left, Right, and Center Live. Join us at the beautiful Ace Hotel Theater in downtown Los Angeles for a night of amusing and insightful commentary on this unique election season. I'll be joined by Kelly Goff, Gene Sperling, and Mona Charon as we dissect Trump versus Clinton, Democrat versus Republican, and fact versus fiction. Buy your tickets today at kcrw.com/LRCLive.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. We start up this week's show at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Take it away, Laura.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We finally had a change of seasons. It's cool and cloudy for once, for the first time in a long time. And I'm visiting right now with Jason Prendergast, who's the executive chef of Tender Greens, right here in Santa Monica, located in the epicenter of the Wednesday Farmers Market. And Jason, you were commenting on the change of seasons. Your windows are decorated with beautiful displays of pumpkins. Tell us what you're shopping for right now.
Right now, we're shopping for a lot of the fall vegetables, the fall root vegetables. So we got celery root, we have sunchokes, we grabbed a lot of the pumpkins for the window display, and we're also going to use them for a lot of risottos, pastas, braises, curries, so all that kind of fun stuff that you'll see on our menu popping up here soon.
For the celery root, so it's a giant, just gnarly, knobby, hairy mess. What's a technique for getting that edible?
So that one we could either use a peeler with a knife, or we can use a peeler. We like to use these U-shaped coon peelers, which are great that you can get at Sur La Table. They make life a lot easier because of the way you hold it, and it's really comfort grip in there. And then from there, we could take it into shaving it thin on the mandolin if we want to use it in one of our salads, or we could just puree it with a little bit of butter and olive oil. So it's a great to cook with, and it's hearty. So you could eat it raw, you could eat it pureed, you could roast it. There's a lot of techniques we could do with it. It's a great helper for us in the kitchen.
How does a celery root taste?
Celery really tastes celery amplified by 10 times fold. So it's got that really earthy, nutty flavor of what you really want with celery, but it doesn't have that moisture that traditional celery has.
Okay. And then for the Jerusalem artichoke, also called a sunchoke, can you describe that flavor?
The sunchoke has a unique flavor in itself. So if you really like something, again, nutty and crunchy, but this one bursts with a little bit more moisture than a celery root does, this one has a great texture. Again, we use it for chips. We use it for, you know, we could do purees with it. We do so many techniques with the Jerusalem artichoke.
So you can eat either one of them hot or cold?
Yes, absolutely. So the actual sunchoke you could pick up from the market right now and snack on it as you're walking through the market. You don't have to shave it thin. It's just break off some of those knobs. It looks knobby, kind of like ginger. But it's really fun to use. You can peel it. You don't have to peel it. So it's really a great, it's great to see this in the market right now.
All right, so what recipe are you going to be doing with one or both of these?
Something we like to do is we like to do one of our grab-and-go items, which is our chips. So what we're going to do is we're going to do our sunchokes. So we slice those very thin and just rinse them to get a little bit of the starch off of that. And then we slowly fry them in olive oil. We just toss with a little bit of, we'd make a scallion and garlic powder, and we're all set and ready to go.
And do they come out nice and crispy and just like a potato chip?
Oh, they're beautiful. They're fantastic. They're really wafer thin, so they kind of crack, almost like Lay's potato chips, but this one has a little bit more localness to it.
All the pumpkins in your window, Eric, are so beautiful. You can kind of walk down the whole length of the sidewalk. And now you're saying you can cook with all of those pumpkins?
Absolutely. So what we do is we have them decorative till Thanksgiving-ish, and then they become a little bit sacrificed. So those get put into specials. We make soups out of them. We do some cool pumpkin butter out of them that we could use for the wintertime. So we use everything.
All right, well, this is great. You can also roast all those squashes, too.
Absolutely. We like to do is one of our fall sides we normally have is traditionally have. We just take a little bit of maple syrup and peel the squash and toss it and roast it in about a 350-degree oven until it's tender and it's perfect.
You use that same peeler to peel the pumpkin squash?
Yeah, we use the same peeler to peel with the pumpkin squash, and then we also like to save the seeds and really rinse them. My mom used to do, and I've kind of adapted to this technique as well. We just leave it in the oven overnight at 150 degrees at home, especially with just a little bit of oil and salt. And so they crisp up, and they're just like perfect pumpkin seeds.
Oh, just a snack on, too.
Just a snack on, yeah.
Now, your Tender Greens right here. You're right here at 2nd and Arizona Avenue. You have other locations. I know you got a big one in Hollywood. This one, though, seems to be one of your busiest locations.
Yeah, we'd like to think it's one of our busiest locations, but we're pretty well spreading out right now. We just have 23 restaurants. We just opened Palo Alto. We're going to open Berkeley soon, so Tender Greens is really growing, and it's a fun time to be in Tender Greens.
Are any other Tender Greens plunked right in the middle of a farmer's market?
Hollywood has their farmer's market over there. Culver City has one. So we've always had restaurants traditionally near farmer's market because it's very important for the relationship for us.
All right. Well, thanks so much. It's so great to see you here. And thanks for the recipes.
Thank you, Laura.
That was Jason Prendergast. He's the executive chef at Tender Greens, located right here at the corner of 2nd Street and Arizona Avenue. On Wednesdays, he's in the middle of the farmer's market. I'm talking now with Romeo Coleman, who's one of the farmers here that grows the sunchokes. And Romeo, they're on the table. A lot of people think that they're ginger. I remember your dad used to say, when people would say, "Is this ginger?" he'd say, "No, it's Marianne." And only people who watch Gilligan's Island even got that joke. But anyway, so you have a lot of sunchokes now. Tell us why you grow them, how you grow them, what the season is.
We've been growing them for a long time, ever since, you know, my dad used to farm or does farm. So we put it in the spring. It's a small tuber. It grows, you know, starts shooting up buds after about 3 weeks. And then grows up to about anywhere from 6 feet to like 10 feet tall. Has a really nice yellow flower on it, similar to a sunflower. And if you're in the field and you go to smell them, they have this very faint smell of chocolate. So from beginning to the end, you know, it takes about 6 months. And then as the tops die down, then that's when we start digging them.
How deep down are they?
Deep down, they can go down to about 18 inches sometimes.
Mm-hmm. They kind of taste a little bit like an artichoke, don't they?
They do taste very... but earthy.
Yeah.
More so than a potato, not as starchy. There's a faint artichoke flavor to them. They've grown more in popularity. They're actually a native to the U.S., similar uses to a potato, but they have a type of inulin in them, which is actually good for diabetics.
They seem to always be smallish. Do they ever get to a bigger size?
Well, now there's a couple different varieties that they've, you know, selected over the years. Our first part of our season, we grow Stampede, which is a smaller variety, but it's a little quicker than most, so it comes off earlier. Second half of the season, we go into a different variety that I'm not going to tell the name of because it's really nice and it works very well for us.
And when does the season start and when does it end?
It starts usually end of August, beginning September, and goes till we run out, which sometimes goes till mid-December.
Mm-hmm. Do they get better as the ground gets colder?
Specifically, no, not really. Mm-hmm. They pretty much have the same flavor through the whole season.
And you dig them, do they stay underground and then you dig every week, or are they all dug up and stored somewhere?
The way we do it is we dig them every week. So they stay in the ground, and as we need them, we dig them out.
When you dig them out, they're that deep. You must be careful not to hit them with a shovel and cut them up. Are they kind of hard to get out? Do you use a fork or what?
No, you just have to have experience.
Okay, just know what you're doing.
Okay. We don't let the rookies do it.
Okay. All right, Romeo. Well, thanks a bunch. You're at the Wednesday Santa Monica, Saturday downtown Santa Monica. We can find them in both places.
Yes, you can.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Romeo Coleman. He's the farmer who's growing these sunchokes up in Carpinteria. And season is in full swing right now, and you can find them on the table. They look a lot like ginger. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We generally leave the political talk to left, right, and center. But with the last presidential debate on the horizon next week, it's become increasingly difficult to ignore. We've learned that Hillary Clinton keeps hot sauce in her bag, and according to Donald, Trump Tower makes a mean taco bowl. Meanwhile, in response to immigration policy, the founder of Latinos for Trump forecasted a taco truck on every corner. A fleet of taco trucks in Houston has countered that comment by doubling as voter registration booths. While we may have our differences, we all have to eat. But what foods and dishes were favored by leaders of bygone days? British gastro detective Fiona Ross knows that behind every great woman and man, there are meals and memories. I've always known about Ronald Reagan's love for jelly beans and that George H.W. Bush hated broccoli, but I think if I'd known more about Nixon's connection to food, I might have had more empathy for him.
Yes, absolutely. One of the really interesting things about Nixon is that he has a Quaker background and he grows up in the first Nixon home in Orange County, California. As his mother, Hannah, ran a pie business and worked endlessly to try and make the family ends meet. She liked making strawberry ice cream, baking pies, and little Richard Nixon would deliver the pies in order to help the family business. Meanwhile, in a kind of role reversal of the sexes, old Mr. Nixon and the boys used to cook all the family meals. And that didn't amount to very much because it was things like tinned pork and beans, tinned chili, burgers, lots and lots of fried eggs. Richard's main role and talent was that he could cook mashed potatoes, which was fantastic. So he would whip them up so that they were very smooth.
Wow. Mashed potatoes a la Richard Nixon. You also researched Eva Braun's first date with Hitler. Tell us what you found out.
The first date is recorded in her private diaries as 1932. And it was in September. That month would always be red letter time for Eva. So her private diaries give this dreamy account of her first date. And it was, according to Eva, the first date of all first dates, because Hitler really pushed the boat out for her, abandoning his modest eating habits to impress her. And there's this kind of weird, chilling romanticism to Eva's diaries when she records exactly even what she wore that first night. You know, she wore a close-fitting blue pullover and was starry-eyed about the supper. She said, "He's the most charming host you can imagine." So first of all, he serves up hors d'oeuvres with Russian caviar, and he sort of chuckles to her and says, "This is, excuse the German accent, this is the best that little Father Stalin can send us." This is followed by, like, a delicate fresh salmon, and then woodcock, which Eva said was so tender it melted on your tongue. Being a bit of a sort of stuffed shirt, though, Hitler didn't touch any of the alcohol, so he served an ice-cold Chablis and Hochzeitstorte, but he didn't touch it. Eva had to do all of the drinking. The final act of chivalry was that Hitler made the coffee while Eva lay on the sofa and talked and talked and talked. She woke up in bed, but she doesn't say who.
You know, I have to say, there are some people that you wish you didn't know so many intimate things about them.
That's right. Yeah, and I always think it's really ironic because, you know, he's got such a reputation as a vegetarian, you know, and you think that's amazing that you've got this evil mastermind that commands the Third Reich and dominates Europe on a diet of cream potatoes and fried eggs. You know, and it's just so strange, isn't it? And yet he's so hypocritical in that first date with Eva because he's feeding her squab, which is young pigeon. You know, he later on advises her that, you know, to keep her skin looking lovely, she should try a face mask of raw veal. And he wants her to wear leather underwear. So clearly, you know, his vegetarianism doesn't extend into the bedroom or getting people into the bedroom.
Wow. Okay, so let's go to his polar opposite, Golda Meir.
Okay.
Your description of her kibbutz life and how she was the head of the chicken operation is just fascinating, but also how it played into her famous kitchen cabinet, where she seemed to have this need to cook and serve and smoke while actually hammering out policy details. I mean, you could just imagine being in that kitchen from your description.
Yeah, I love that about her. I think she's a really fascinating woman. And I think what she does, which a lot of female leaders seem to feel the need to kind of, or are forced to divorce themselves from that kind of domesticity. I mean, I've researched Indira Gandhi and come across almost no account of her cooking or eating or anything like that. All right, it's a bit different when I've researched Margaret Thatcher. I'm not sure if you've heard much about Hillary Clinton cooking. All right, you hear what she carries in her bag, hot sauce, she said, but not her actually cooking. Whereas Golda Meir, almost because of her position, perhaps as the mother of a nation, has this very maternal approach to food, politics, and mixes it all up and is really comfortable with doing that. She's a real hands-on, practical lady. And I love the idea of, you know, her puffing away baggy-eyed on her cigarettes while serving up cake to Moshe Dayan. It's just a wonderful image.
Let's talk about Churchill.
Okay, Churchill.
I mean, so much of Churchill's adulthood when he was in power was during wartime and there was rationing. Did that affect his diet greatly?
Well, it affected his diet in all sorts of different ways. During rationing, he was fortunate in that he, of course, had a sort of small stately home in Chartwell, but it's a beautiful house and it's surrounded by land, and obviously that land was quite rich in game. So, for instance, things like partridges went unrationed. So Churchill could basically supply his table with chicken and ducks from Chartwell, from the houses, because they were always a reliable source of protein. But the problem was that he was on very friendly terms with all his animals. So he was always wondering if it was a bird he was on friendly terms with that he was eating at the table. He even had this terrific habit of making a honking noise when he was out in one of the meadows in Chartwell. And this bar-headed goose from Canada would come waddling towards him and would actually walk along with him, but keeping a respectful web foot or two behind him, looking at the lakes of Chartwell and apparently helping his inspection. He called it his flag lieutenant. So once in earlier times, in the lean years of World War I, he refused to carve a goose, telling his wife, "You'll have to carve it. He was my best friend." He wasn't very keen on eating animals that he was on familiar terms with. And he wouldn't have been very pleased with cream rationing. Because cream eventually ended up being rationed, I think, in about 1943. But cream was always a number one spot on his menu. He always says, you know, you should eat plenty of cream. It coats the sheaths of the nerves, which sounds really scientific, doesn't it?
So in all this research you did, was there one person for you that stands out as either a surprise or you just fell in love with them after discovering their sort of dietary habits?
Churchill, obviously, is a big favourite of mine. But there's incredible characters like Marilyn Monroe, I feel, was a very poignant figure. And somebody like Marilyn Monroe really cared about what she put on your table and lies alongside people like the poetess Sylvia Plath, because both of them had this real dedication to good home cooking and served up delicious meals. And then at the same time, I'm really quite fond of characters like Freud, who was one of the early food foragers, you know, and Freud liked nothing better than wandering around the countryside picking his own mushrooms and taking them, serving them at the table to his children.
He had a particular foraging hat.
Yes, that's right. Yes, a green foraging hat. And he would throw it when he thought he saw some mushrooms, he would throw it in the direction of the mushrooms, hoping to cover them, and then order the children, shout at the children, "Get them!" You know, these children, all this gaggle of children would run across, you know, to help Freud with his foraging. So he's a lovely figure.
Fiona Ross's new book is called Dining with Leaders, Rebels, Heroes, and Outlaws. It's part of her Dining with Destiny series. Next up, it's fry bread, squash, and buffalo. That and more staples of Native American cuisine. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Foraging local ingredients has become so on trend in the high-end restaurant world, one imagines hordes of land-savvy gatherers exploring native terrain to bring fodder to chefs. One thing's missing, though: Native American restaurants. With diners constantly looking for the next new thing, why hasn't First Nations food caught on? Emily Dury examined why fry bread, squash, and buffalo are not on trend. First of all, can Native American cuisine easily be defined?
No, it can't. And I think that's one of the issues, that if you are looking at Native American tribes in California, for instance, you might be talking about something like salmon. But if you're looking at tribes in the Midwest, you might be talking about something like buffalo. There are more than 500 tribes across the U.S., and they each have different types of food, and they each use different ingredients. So pinning down a definition is difficult, which makes it hard to market.
But it seems like it would just make it beautiful to market in each regional area, given that this sort of local and foraging interest in particularly the high-end restaurant world, people are so much more open to it.
I think things may be moving that direction, and I think you have diners that are definitely open to the idea of trying Native American food, but I think you have landlords who are maybe a little bit risk-averse and are going to go with something like a pizza joint or a burger joint that they think is a good financial decision instead of taking a chance on Native American food.
In Native American communities, is there a restaurant culture?
There really isn't. Most Native American families will gather with each other or with friends, but the idea of going to a restaurant is relatively foreign, and so that's also something where you do see Native chefs, but you don't necessarily see them bringing their cuisine to a restaurant situation.
I know that you examined a younger chef who was trying to do something a bit more fast casual, I guess we would call it, which is very interesting to me as opposed to, you know, stepping in on the high end. Could you share some of his difficulties that he had getting going?
Sure. So Ben Jacobs is in Denver, and he owns a restaurant with another business partner called Tokabe, and it is a fast casual Native American restaurant. And he serves different things like Indian tacos, which are fry bread with different toppings. So you'll have different vegetables, squash, for instance, different sauces. He serves different stews, things like that. And these are generally in the sort of $8 to $12 range. But he has had some trouble. He told The Atlantic many years ago that he planned to open multiple restaurants in the future, and he's only opened two so far. One of the issues, and we talked about this earlier, is he's had trouble securing space. Landlords have been relatively reluctant to rent to him. But he's also, he really wants to use Native American purveyors. So he wants to source buffalo, for instance, from Native American tribes. And there aren't that many tribes or purveyors that he can go to. And so he's relatively limited in terms of his ability to expand. And the other thing that he really wants to do is support local Native American youth. And so he will take young people, teenagers who may not have any restaurant experience, and he'll invite them to come to his restaurant and to work in his restaurant. And he asks them for recipes. He talks to their families. But that takes a lot of time and effort. And he doesn't necessarily fire people if they do something wrong. He works with them to correct it.
He's trying to create a culture.
Exactly.
I would expect that there are quite a few expectations of food served, and maybe these expectations are based on stereotypes. Could you give us some examples of that?
Sure. Most of the dishes at Tokabe do start with fry bread. And the reason that Ben did that is fry bread is relatively common across tribes. So he uses that as a base. But that does have its own issues and its own sort of fraught history. When tribes were uprooted and sort of forcibly moved around the United States, they often only had several ingredients, and fry bread was sort of the only thing that they could make. So some Native Americans don't see fry bread as a positive thing. Ben sees it as something of a unifier. So that's one issue that he often grapples with. And then, yes, there are people who come into his restaurant and they have stereotypical ideas of what the food is going to be or what the servers are going to look like. And, I mean, he's had people ask him why his servers don't have braids, for instance. So he does run into stereotypes. And he's pretty patient with people, and he spends a lot of time educating people about Native Americans in general, about Native cuisine. But it takes a lot of his time.
I can only imagine. And I also would imagine that the regionality comes into play as well, particularly if he's trying to source from tribes. For example, salmon wouldn't be available year-round.
Exactly, right. And in a fast casual situation, more so than in a fine dining situation, I think that diners are expecting consistency. And so he may not be able to offer salmon, for instance, year-round. And so he's been reluctant to introduce some of those ingredients that would be seasonal. I think that in some situations we're seeing diners become more accepting of that idea. So he may have more luck moving in that direction in the future. But I think that is a challenge right now.
And I would imagine the price point, too.
Right, exactly. Buffalo, for instance, is significantly more expensive than beef. And so if he's serving buffalo and people, you know, equate it mentally with a hamburger, they're expecting a $5 hamburger, and that's not what they're getting. So they are having to pay more in some situations, and he does get pushback.
Where are some of the more prominent restaurants that serve Native American food located?
His is one, and it's not a fine dining situation, but the fact that there are two in the Denver, sort of Colorado Springs area is relatively unique. There are fry bread stands, for instance, all over Oklahoma. You see some restaurants in Arizona. You actually see some in Minnesota. They're kind of dotted all over, but there aren't that many.
Since your article has come out, it's kind of fascinating. There seems to be a moment of surging forward. I noticed that a chef who's been around for a while in the Midwest, who goes under the name of the Sioux Chef, S-I-O-U-X, has started a Kickstarter for his restaurant.
Right. I do think that we maybe are seeing a moment, although I would caution that, you know, the owners of Takabe thought that there might be a moment a handful of years ago, and there really wasn't. But I do think that sort of conditions are ripe for a moment to happen. I think that diners are looking for healthy food. They're looking for local ingredients. They're often willing to pay slightly more for those ingredients. So there may be a moment.
Yeah, and people are looking for stories, too.
Yeah, they want to know where their food is coming from. They like knowing the history. They like the story around it.
That was Emily Drury. She's Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic. You can read her article on the dearth of Native American restaurants at kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we hear about food shaming from a writer and producer who has experienced it firsthand. When the show continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. And one way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. You can put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off, too. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. For many of us, the aroma of family food cloaks us in a complex web of identity. You walk into your house and the smell makes you know you're at home. Conversely, the familiar smell of home is too often the stench of someone else's unfamiliar. Washington, D.C. writer and public radio producer Ruth Tamm wrote a powerful essay for the Washington Post titled, How It Feels When White People Shame Your Culture's Food, Then Make It Trendy. Describe the aroma of your childhood.
The aroma of my childhood. The dish that I began with in that essay is my father's ngalam, which is kind of like this braised beef brisket stew, and it has tendon and turnips, a lot of offal that I don't think a lot of people are used to. There's cinnamon and there's orange peel, and it's this kind of thick, heavy, sweet, meaty smell that I never really thought about growing up. It was just how our food smelled, but until I heard about it from an outsider, I began to think of it as something that was gross or stinky as opposed to warm and delicious. And so it's that shift in perspective that was brought on by someone's insults that I write about. And now I've come to really think of it fondly, which shows the growth into adulthood.
How old were you when the shame first happened? And I imagine it was a schoolmate.
I was in high school. I had always kind of picked up on the reality that my house might smell different from other people. I never really began to quantify it as something that was negative until someone told me, a high school classmate, that it smelled like Chinese grossness. And it never occurred to me to think of it that way, and it really hurt my feelings, as you might imagine. That comment kind of set me off. There were a number of other things that made me feel like an outsider, but that's when I kind of began to isolate myself from Chinese food because it was referred to as being gross.
You know, when you think about how cruel children can be to one another, it's so fascinating and sad that one stupid remark can cause such a shift in behavior and in the way one looks at oneself. You actually started conditioning yourself to minimize your enthusiasm for the food you grew up with. How did your parents deal with that? Did they notice that it was happening?
I'm sure they did. And I think it's important to remember that it wasn't just one comment. I think I got a lot of criticism when that essay came out because people were like, well, maybe you should have been stronger. Kids make fun of each other. That's normal. But I'm not the only one that has experienced this, and it's definitely not a one-time thing that happened to me. It happened over, you know, a series of years during my most vulnerable years. And I'm not sure if my parents were hurt by it, but I think they probably recognize a change. Ngawam used to be, and it still is, but it was my favorite dish growing up, and I started complaining about how it smelled. I started, you know, opening up windows. I started washing walls in my parents' home because I was so embarrassed by the smell of the food, and I just wanted to get it out, and I wanted to be a normal family like everybody else, normal, in this case, meaning white.
Wow. Like that is something wonderful to aspire to. You also had a fish tank in the family room.
Yeah. The fish tank was a creation of my father's. If you go to Chinese restaurants these days, probably ones that might be characterized as more authentic, ones that are aspiring to be Cantonese Chinese restaurants, you'll see a big fish tank and there's seafood in this fish tank. And it's not typically, you know, one for show or for display or decoration. The fish tank is to keep fish and other seafood fresh so that when you want a seafood dish, you can just take it from the tank. And that's kind of what my father was doing. He loves to fish, and he would bring home fish from his trips, and he would put them in the tank, and we would save them until he wanted to have fish for a meal. But that's not something that my friends were used to. So they would come over, and the fish tank would be bubbling in the background, and they'd be like, we'd be watching TV or a movie. They'd be like, can we turn that off? You know, what's going on with that fish tank? There were no decorations in the fish tank. And I tried to pretend it was something else than what it really was. And when they found out that the fish were for eating, everyone that I was friends with was grossed out by it, and it made me feel bad about it.
It's so interesting, because reading your essay, I went back in my mind to my childhood as a latchkey kid. So every day after school, I was at somebody's house, and I became just a food voyeur. And I think about what my response would have been if I'd walked into your house with the fish tank. I just would have been like, I would have asked you a million questions culminating with, can I watch your dad kill the fish and make dinner?
That would have been fun to have someone who was genuinely interested. I, you know, inversely did the same, but for what was typically mainstream American food, I would go over and I was fascinated. I would love to peer into my friends' pantries, and I loved looking at, you know, the food that they have, because it was all food that I saw on TV and food that I thought was like normal food. And I loved that. But I would, you know, I still probably wouldn't let anybody in my parents' pantry, because if you think my family's house smells like food, the pantry, which is like stuffed with dried things, preservative things, that will probably like knock you off your feet.
I just really believe so strongly that smell is this atavistic part of us. It's one of the oldest parts of our neurological system. And how our olfactory organs respond to smell and memory is so primal that when someone gives you the back of their hand for it, they're touching something so deep. When did you finally start to come out of this? And how did it make you feel when all of a sudden all these things that were seen as being gross and labeled strictly the other has now become like just celebrated on every type of media you can imagine?
Well, I would say that it was a pretty complicated process, which began with me moving out of the Midwest, moving out of the town that I grew up in, which was majority white. I went out to Boston for college, and there were more Asian Americans there, more Asians there on campus. And I became a little bit more comfortable with the fact that I was part of this community that I didn't really want to be a part of when I was growing up. I found security in that. I found comfort in that. Even though I was trying to like shed my Asian American identity for so long, I was able to kind of be more comfortable with it by the time I got to college. When I graduated, that's when I started to see more, when I had, you know, spending money and I could go out to places and I could look at menus. I noticed that there are so many Chinese dishes, Korean dishes, Japanese dishes. Japanese has always been fashionable, I think, for longer here in the U.S. But I saw these cuisines that were previously thought of as too smelly, too strong, too obviously derived from an animal, that were somehow on these menus, and not just like fusion restaurants, but like your average sports bar. I would see like kimchi burgers and a number of other things. There are so many weird fusion, you know, small plates options these days. And it was a range. I felt a range of emotions. There were some times where I felt frustrated, or I thought something was funny, or, you know, maybe sometimes I thought I would actually try something like that. But it felt unsettling to see that something that I was so embarrassed about as a kid come back and be presented to mainstream America as cool and hip. And it was always, it seemed to be done by people who weren't maybe interested in providing context to Chinese food in America. It just seemed like it was coming from a place of trying to respond to a trend. And that's when I think it started to really not sit that well with me, when I thought it was obscuring over the role of Asian Americans and Asians in this country. That's when I decided to write about it.
You don't feel that when a food becomes appreciated by greater numbers of people outside the cultural community of the food, want to embrace it and enjoy it, that denotes something negative to you?
It's not an inherently negative thing. In fact, it's a great thing. I think food is an excellent gateway to new cultures and learning about new people and understanding them and learning how to empathize with people. It's just when it's done in a way that strips the role of the people who brought the food here in the first place. That's when I think it's unfortunate. Your food experience, whether you're cooking it or eating it, could be so much more valuable and meaningful if you understand how the food got to your plate. Americans are finding so much more interest in how food gets to their plate these days. There's a whole farm-to-table movement. There's all this history and backstory, and there are bloggers who are exploring, you know, how things are grown and how they get to their plate. I don't understand why that interest doesn't translate to the cultural aspect of food. You could have such a more rewarding experience, that's what I believe, if you explore the stories of the people who brought the food here in the first place.
What has the online conversation been like since your article came out?
Well, I think there was a mix of responses. I think from people who have immigrant backgrounds, whether they're Asian or not, have responded pretty well to it because people have experiences like this. Whether you grew up in the Midwest, like I did, or elsewhere, you had something of a lunchbox moment where you brought something to school or someone came over to your house and you were ashamed for what you were eating. And if it wasn't food, it was some other thing. You were made to feel like an outsider. And so for a lot of people like me, they related to it. And then for a lot of people, I think they were confused about why I was writing it to begin with, because they thought that, oh, Chinese food has been in the U.S. for so long. This is not a new phenomenon. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the trendification of Asian food. And that's when people, I think, kind of missed the message. But I think that the response to this kind of perspective is constantly being brought up now because people see examples of it everywhere. Just in the past month, there was a Bon Appetit video published on Facebook about a white Philadelphia chef explaining how to eat pho, and people were upset by that. It wasn't my essay and my experience, but people had the same response to it as I did when it comes to people making Asian food and passing it off as theirs. Epicurious is a food blog. They tweeted, or a food website, they tweeted about mumbo sauce as if it's a new phenomenon. Disney posted a gumbo recipe on their Facebook page for The Princess and the Frog that does not resemble what people know to be real gumbo. You know, these kinds of examples are cropping up all the time, and people are responding to it in a way that shows that people are interested in the cultural history of food.
When you were growing up, did you have the sort of Eddie Wong moment of wanting your mom to buy you Lunchables?
Oh, absolutely. But my mom was very, let's call it frugal, and would not, you know, buy Lunchables for her four kids.
I don't know. I was so grossed out by that kind of food when I was a kid.
I'm definitely grossed out now. I realize now that the food that my parents made for me was complex and involved so much work. Because I know this because I'm trying to make it myself now. And I have a lot of appreciation for it. But as a kid, I felt like it was too hard to be eating and cooking this stuff. It was not worth it.
Yeah. How you describe being next to your father as he made it, and particularly that moment in which he stuffed all the spices into a little bag and then gave it to you to sniff. A really lovely moment.
Yeah, I really miss that time with him. And I remember really fondly just loving that process. And it really pains me to remember that someone took that pride in his work and his ability to cook for us, and they took that away with their comments. And I will always, you know, look back on that and feel sad that I was susceptible to that kind of criticism. But I, as an adult, will remember what my father has done for our family. And I try to make the kinds of dishes he makes. I make a soup version of ngalam, and he coaches me over the phone. He sends me spices and boxes, and I try to do the same thing that he does. And when I'm with friends and family that come visit, I do the same thing. I put the cinnamon, the star anise, the cloves, the ginger, you know, all the spices into a bag, and I give it to them to smell. And it's an act of sharing what I didn't feel like I was comfortable sharing when I was a kid.
That's writer and producer Ruth Tam. Find a link to her article, How It Feels When White People Shame Your Culture's Food, Then Make It Trendy, on our website. Next, we travel to Gardena to hear about some French fries that have gone viral on Instagram. Stay with us.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. You can keep up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Now it's time to talk about what is arguably America's favorite side dish, French fries. But these French fries you're about to hear about are treated like a main dish, served up by a guy who goes by the name Mr. Fries Man. A single order of his fries will set you back from $11 to $24. But the fries really are more of the vehicle for what smothers them: steak, chicken, shrimp, or snow crab, covered in the sauce of your choice, lemon garlic, for example, or barbecue, maybe teriyaki or Caribbean jerk. But getting your hands on an order isn't as simple as hitting up a drive-thru or pulling up to a food truck. This is not street food. It's not a pop-up. It's something entirely different. Mr. Fries Man is part of a growing community of home chefs in Los Angeles who use Instagram to sell their food. In Gardena, KCRW's David Weinberg has the story.
I've been following Mr. Fries Man on Instagram for a few months, admiring his photos of French fries, or at least the tips of French fries, peeking out from underneath extravagant mountains of seafood and meat covered in rich, creamy sauces. So a couple weeks ago, I decided it was finally time to place an order. I ordered a trio plate, three flavors over one order of fries: steak teriyaki, lemon garlic shrimp and snow crab, and buffalo chicken. The woman on the phone told me to text her my email address so she could send an invoice. And after I paid, I got another text. It said, "Drive to the Smart and Final parking lot on Redondo Beach Boulevard in Gardena. Park near the wall and look for a gray Pontiac Grand Prix." When I pulled into the lot, I saw the Grand Prix idling. There was a man and a woman inside. I parked and walked over and said, "Are you Mr. Fries Man?" The guy nodded, and he asked me my name. Then he reached into the back seat and pulled out a styrofoam container with my name written on it. This was the first time I'd ever bought French fries from a guy in a parking lot, and I had a lot of questions. Mainly, who is Mr. Fries Man? And it turns out the guy who handed me my order, he was not Mr. Fries Man. The real Mr. Fries Man is a guy named Craig Batiste.
My name is Craig. I'm Mr. Fryman. Everybody know that. I say hello.
One of the first things I learned about Craig was his catchphrase.
Hello.
Which he uses as liberally as the lemon garlic sauce he drizzles on his best-selling menu item.
The most popular one is lemon garlic shrimp.
Mr. Fryman is open on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, and every second Sunday. The menu changes constantly, but there's always at least five meats available: chicken, asada, shrimp, snow crab, and bacon, and at least half a dozen sauces. From these, Craig makes dozens of combinations:
buffalo shrimp, buffalo chicken, barbecue bacon ranch chicken, green chili enchiladas, teriyaki pineapple express shrimp fries, jerk chicken, jerk shrimp, and it's not even all of them.
And then there are the specialty fries that pop up sporadically on the menu:
shrimp and crawfish scampi fries, catfish, one of my favorites, oyster, pork belly adobo, fiesta corn fries. That's like how the Spanish Mexicans, they make like the corn. We just do it like that on top of fries. The pineapple pizza turkey fries, the colossal ones. A lot of people don't understand. The colossal ones is like a colossal burger: pastrami, Thousand Island grilled onions, cheese, and fries. Hello.
With his thin goatee and closely cropped hair, Craig looks like a stockier version of Cuba Gooding Jr. He told me I was the second person to tell him that.
I ain't fat, but I ain't skinny. You gotta be comfortable with your skin.
Mr. Friesman's business is run out of a small two-bedroom back house in Gardena, where Craig, his fiancée Dorothy, and their three kids live. Sunday through Thursday, Craig works at Pepsi, where his shift starts at 3 a.m. After work, he heads straight home to start cooking. Dorothy usually starts prepping at about 6 a.m. And at some point in the morning, Craig will post that day's menu on Instagram. And then the phone starts ringing.
Mr. Friesman. Okay, is this your first time ordering with us?
In between taking phone orders, Dorothy works in the kitchen, which is tiny, about 5 feet by 8 feet. She stands over a small crockpot-sized deep fryer. She's dredging cubes of chicken and flour for the buffalo fried chicken fries. When she and Craig first started, they only had two of these small countertop fryers.
Because we didn't really take it so seriously. It was like, yeah, right, no one's going to really order.
Back then, they were only open one day a week, and they were mostly selling to friends and family. Dorothy had been laid off from her job as a medical technician. They needed some extra income.
First fries I made, I put a barbecue bacon ranch on there and chicken. They was like, interesting. Let's see how this is going to taste. Said, oh, I got another one for y'all. Shrimp enchilada fries. They loved them.
All Craig needed was a name for his business.
I was going to call it Mr. Potato Man at first.
Now, everyone was pretty much in agreement that Mr. Potato Man was a terrible name.
My sister was like, nah. Steffi was like, nah, you can't do that. Man, you the Fry Man. I said, huh? The Fry Man. And I just put Mr. Fries Man on there. Hello.
Business was slow at first, but then two things happened that changed everything. The first was the hashtag.
I started posting on Instagram, and one of my buddies, Devin, said, man, you got to use your hashtags. That's going to get the followers up. I said, man, I don't believe in that crap. And I started doing it, and then next thing you know, followers started coming in. I said, oh, this is getting serious.
Craig would post a photo of some fries and add as many as 30 hashtags. Things like fries, best fries, good eats, great eats, Compton, Watts, Long Beach, Miami. He also started tagging foodie celebrities and other nearby home chefs. People like Taco Mel, who sells tacos and burritos in South Central.
He came by, got some fries, and he posted it, and it just... I woke up the next morning and had 3,000 new followers. Hello!
Craig started connecting with other home chefs through Instagram. People like Real Trap Kitchen, who you may have seen on the new cooking show hosted by Martha Stewart and Snoop Dogg. And All Flavor No Grease, a guy named Keith Garrett, who sells $18 quesadillas out of his front yard in Watts and has 58,000 Instagram followers.
We all support each other. We swap a plate out. Man, you bring this one, I got this. Man, you take these fries. What fries you want? What plate you want? You got this for the day? Yeah, it's like a secret society, a food secret society.
Craig and these other chefs cross-promote each other's businesses through social media. And as a result, Mr. Friesman has seen a big bump in business. And then on Thursday, September 8th, came the second big spike in Craig's business. It was a total surprise. At about 1 in the morning, people started calling to order fries. Lots of people. Dorothy answered the phone and explained that they weren't open. But eventually she just gave up, put her phone on silent, and went to sleep. When they opened that next morning, it was their busiest day to date. It was all because of a rapper named Nipsey Hussle. Look, just got a call from my bank to tell me that we hit again and keep doing my thing. The boys on fire, money wires every day. Just about the time Dorothy's phone started ringing, Nipsey Hussle, who has over 1 million followers on Instagram, shared one of Mr. Friesman's posts on his feed. Since then, Mr. Friesman has reached 33,000 followers on Instagram. And to keep up with all the new business, he's had to upgrade to an industrial-grade deep fryer, who he named Big Bertha.
Yep, Big Bertha. It's my baby.
Big Bertha's out back, behind the house, on a small concrete patio, where Craig's friend Barney, who goes by The Barney Rebel on Instagram, is cooking fries.
Oh, I don't just cook fries. I rap as well and do a whole lot of other stuff.
This morning, Barney was running a little late. He didn't get off work until 3 a.m. from his job at the airport, where he works the night shift at Sammy's Pizza. But after getting a few hours of sleep, he was here, cooking fries in the triple-digit heat.
And when they rise, that's how you know they're done.
Once the fries are cooked, Craig sprinkles cheddar cheese on each order, then adds the meat, sauce, and garnish. He puts them into a large, insulated delivery bag to go to the pickup location, which used to be a nearby donut shop.
Until they kicked us out of there. Yeah. And one dude like, hey, don't be selling no... Don't be selling no drugs. Man, we ain't selling no drugs, man. You want some fresh fries?
I gotta say, the first time I got fries, I was like, this does kind of feel like a drug deal.
Hello.
Once all the orders are ready, Barney grabs the delivery bag and heads out to the new pickup location, the Smart and Final parking lot, where one by one, customers show up to pick up their fries.
Oh, I ordered the lemon garlic shrimp and chicken.
Have you been ordered before?
No, this is my first time.
Oh, nice. How'd you find out about it?
Oh, I was on the homie Nipsey Hussle page. Oh, yeah. I seen it on there. And I'm like, okay, let me go check it out.
One customer I met drove all the way from Anaheim. Another was in town from San Francisco. And there were a few regulars, like Kima, who said this is her 10th time ordering.
Yeah, I've become a regular. They're good. I sent a few people here.
After all the orders were picked up, Barney hopped in the car and headed back to the house. He doesn't get paid for this work. It's been that way since the very beginning.
I was just volunteering, you know, just because I seen the vision and I just wanted to support. And we just all having a good time. I feel like that's what life's about. You're supposed to be doing something that you love doing instead of stressing over things that you have no control over. You only live once. YOLO. Do they still say YOLO?
When we get back, the house is filled up with family and friends. Another home chef has stopped by to swap plates. Craig and Dorothy's son is home from school. And it's easy to see why Barney's helping out here for free. It feels like a party, even though it's 103 degrees outside and the house doesn't have air conditioning. Craig leans against the table and wipes his forehead. He's looking a little tired, but when I ask him about it, he stands up straight and tells me,
I don't get tired.
He doesn't get tired.
Nah, I don't though.
Dorothy rolls her eyes and then laughs as Craig turns up the Curtis Mayfield song on the stereo. There are still two more pickups to go before they eventually sell out of fries and call it a day.
I need some more water.
Barney, drop more fries, please.
Hello.
That feature comes to us from KCRW reporter David Weinberg. Head over to our blog to see a slideshow of the Mr. Friesman crew making their crucially salty fries. But don't say we didn't warn you. One look, and we know you'll be on Instagram buying an order of Texas fries and hot-footing it over to that parking lot in Gardena. We close out the show with another food we love to fry, chicken. For that, we turn to our favorite food critic, Jonathan Gold. Jonathan, where are we headed today?
Crenshaw District, Arlington Heights, Mid-City. People haven't really decided on the exact name of this neighborhood. But we're going to Gus's Fried Chicken.
I think it's Mid-City because it's near me. Who's running this fried chicken joint?
Gus's is a chain. The first branch was in a small town in Tennessee. It's famous in Memphis, and it's in about, I don't know, 16, 20 other cities in the country, I think. And this is its first, you know, branch on the West Coast.
I found it really interesting that they chose that neighborhood because usually when chains come in from the outside, they pick somewhere like downtown LA or Santa Monica.
I love the neighborhood they're in. I mean, there's a couple of places that I like to go to right around there. I mean, the wonderful Korean pork barbecue / pork neck soup place, Hamji Park, is right down the block. And the wonderful Guatemalan cevicheria, La Cevicheria, is very close. But it's not what you call a restaurant neighborhood exactly. I'm stoked. It's in like a sort of a retrofitted corner place. I think it was a Korean bar before that, maybe recording studio sometime in its distant past.
Yeah, part of me feels like it was either originally maybe a post office or a bank. It's a really beautiful old building. So let's talk about the food.
Well, the food is fried chicken, basically. Not only basically, I mean, that's the only protein on the menu. It's hot chicken, they call it, but it's nothing like the incredible heat of the Nashville-style chicken.
It's not punitive.
No. It's like you put a little bit of hot sauce in there somewhere. When it first comes out of the fryer, it's magnificent. It's really crunchy. It's sort of a burnished red gold. The pieces are bigger than they are small, and the heat just creeps up on you in a way that's really pleasant. Unlike the Nashville style at places like Howling Rays or Nickel Diner, it becomes noticeably less crunchy over about 10 minutes.
So is it the kind that if you don't attack it right away, you end up with sort of the flabby skin and not so exciting breading?
It's better than that. I mean, it has integrity, but you're definitely missing part of its glory. It's not great as next day picnic chicken.
What about take home chicken?
It will probably last long enough till you get home. I think they do a huge part of their business as takeout, but it's much better if you eat it there. That's a lot of the deep frying effect anyway, right? It's like donuts. Even Winchell's is incredibly good if you get it right out of the fryer.
It's true. Are you eating half chickens, parts, a sandwich, or all of the above?
I personally tend to order specials. So you can get like a dozen wings, or you can get 8 or 16 pieces of dark meat, and you have a whole table full of people around and you order all the sides. I think they sell mostly in the form of plates, which will be, you know, 2 or 3 pieces that you get to choose, plus baked beans and slaw and white bread. There's always white bread involved.
Always.
And you can get it a lot of other ways. Let's say you order an 8-piece dark, which is, I think, a strong move. It comes out on a big platter. There are 3 pieces of white bread that, let's face it, nobody's going to touch, but it has to be there. It's part of the architectural form of the Southern chicken plate.
So if you want to make white bread tacos.
You could make white bread tacos. The baked beans are standard. The seasoned fries are actually pretty good. There's a really nice gooey mac and cheese. It's not the kind that somebody has spent a long time working on the bechamel for. It's like
a stovetop.
Yeah, it's your grandma's mac and cheese if your grandma made good mac and cheese, and really sort of meaty, porky greens with that sort of like little bit of collard stank. I like that little bit of collard stank.
Yeah. Good greens are very important.
That's kind of it. You might want to start with an appetizer.
Why?
That's true. Why? Except that—
Are there appetizers?
Sort of. There's the best fried pickles I've ever had. And I actually would claim to have a certain amount of expertise in the fried pickle department. I've been to the famous fried pickle places in the South.
They're actually really, really good.
Every place I've ever had them before, they do the pickle chips and they bread and they fry. Here, they cut them into spears.
Ooh, that's very nice.
You get the meatiness of it. It preserves the sort of—
pickle integrity?
The pickle integrity, the garlic flavor comes through. They're coated really nicely with the batter. It doesn't slip off. Almost everywhere you get fried pickles, you have one bite and then you're left with a really hot pickle and sort of an empty checker-shaped pickle casing. Made out of batter. They have integrity here. The fried green tomatoes are really good too, probably in the same way and for the same way.
Wow.
And then you're done and you get a piece of chess pie if you have room for it, or probably even if you don't, because chess pie is undeniable good thing.
I think this might be one of these instances in which people are listening and they are turning their cars.
Well, it's the chess pie.
Towards the sound of the frying. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan. By the way, if they ask if you want your chess pie heated, say no.
No.
Because the heating, it gives it a nice cloud-like consistency, but it just destroys the crust.
Spoken by a man who knows.
We do talk about pie around here, don't we?
That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Gus's Fried Chicken in Mid-City. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Well, that's it for this week's show. Go to kcrw.com or download our mobile app to listen to the show. As always, so many thanks to the good food team. That's
Abby Fentress-Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine. Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
Jackie Luke,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
And I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more good food.